Now, members of the House Ethics Committee convene today, and they're expected to call for an investigation into the widening congressional page scandal. And there are more rumblings today of Republican calls for House Speaker Dennis Hastert to resign over his response to the scandal. Adding to those calls, a former congressional page is now saying that as far back as 10 years ago, he was receiving sexually suggestive emails from now former Florida Congressman Mark Foley. And yesterday, Foley's former chief of staff claimed that more than 3 years ago, he told Dennis Hastert's office that Foley was behaving inappropriately towards teenage pages, something Hastert's office denies. Well, Boston Globe congressional correspondent Rick Klein joins us on the line from Rhode Island, where he's covering the re-election campaign of liberal Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee, who faces Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. But Rick, I'm wondering, are people talking about the page scandal there?
Yeah, there's a lot of buzz around this among both candidates' camps. In fact, yesterday was supposed to be a very big day for Senator Chafee. He had Senator John McCain campaigning with him, one of the most prominent members of the Republican Party, and all of the events with Senator McCain were dominated by questions about the Foley matter, and the message of Senator McCain coming to town really lost in the flurry of questions about Congressman Foley.
Well, and maybe to get back on the radar, Senator McCain called for an independent investigation of the Foley email scandal. Does he mean independent of the Ethics Committee that's meeting today?
That's right. He's talking about a high-profile panel of maybe former lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, bipartisan, people with really strong reputations and totally separate from the current process. His feeling is that people that are too involved, too close to House leadership on either side of the aisle, would be suspect.
Well, and you talk about people perhaps not being able to be independent. Let's explain that might apply to the Ethics Committee. In the past, the Ethics Committee has gone to outside investigators, but they were inactive in this Congress for over a year because Dennis Hastert didn't like the way the committee wanted to admonish former House Leader Tom DeLay. In fact, he changed the committee chair. So is there a question of whether this committee in particular will be able to investigate Dennis Hastert, who's been so involved with the committee?
Well, it is funny that this committee has spent 16 of the 21 months so far of this Congress not meeting at all, not even organized, because of partisan infighting and disagreements between Speaker Hastert and Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. So there is a lot of question about how quickly they can turn something around, given that they haven't had a history of working together in the past, and frankly, whether anyone will really trust the conclusions. It's very possible this is an evenly divided committee between Democrats and Republicans. Will they be able to get a majority of members to agree on who was culpable? This committee has been, in the past, in previous Congresses, among the most bipartisan by design and by practice. But in a situation like this, with an election a month away only, it's hard to imagine that they'll be able to find consensus on some of the more questionable contentions about, particularly about Speaker Hastert's relationship and his response to all of this.
Well, former Congressman Mark Foley's former aide, the one we mentioned, who contradicts Dennis Hastert's version of what he knew and when he knew it, is the fourth person to do so. Hastert's office still insists he did nothing wrong. But as you write, many Republicans are starting to distance themselves from him.
Yeah, that's been one of the more remarkable developments of the past week. It started with Tom Reynolds, the head of the Republicans' House committee efforts, who said that he did warn Hastert earlier than Hastert recalled. Next out of the box was John Boehner, the number two Republican. He said that in his mind, the Speaker was responsible for the handling of all this. And yesterday, Roy Blunt, the number three Republican, came out and said something similar, said that this is not how he would have handled it. And certainly, if anyone had asked for his advice, he would have handled it much differently. That's seen as a signal that some people believe that Hastert's days are numbered, because we're seeing some high-ranking Republicans begin to really distance themselves from his handling. The sort of united front we usually associate with House Republican leadership definitely showing signs of cracking.
Well, meanwhile, Rick, as you say, everyone there in Rhode Island seems to be talking about Dennis Hastert, but Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice made a surprise visit to Baghdad today. She'd been on a diplomatic trip to Israel. Any sense where you are that, you know, who would have thought it would come to this, but this might be a distraction to try to get people to focus on Iraq as opposed to Dennis Hastert?
Well, I think the Republicans would definitely like to change the debate right now. The president has been making a series of fundraising speeches. The First Lady has as well. No one's noticing. This scandal has shown no signs of abating. I mean, every day seems to snowball with new developments, and that's one of the factors that is leaning toward Hastert getting pushed out sooner rather than later.
Congressional correspondent Rick Klein of the Boston Globe in Rhode Island. Well, our next guest says that the Bush administration has been masterful at distracting the public during the Iraq War. Shock and awe, mission accomplished, uranium from Niger, not. Heck of a job, Brownie, Abu Ghraib, fix the intelligence around the policy, fake reporters, real embeds. It's all there in mind-numbing detail and a graphic timeline. A scathing criticism of the Bush administration, but also of the what New York Times columnist Frank Rich calls spineless Democrats and a national media that behave like a White House steno pool. His new book is called The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. And Frank Rich joins us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you really think of the war in Iraq?
Well, I guess the point I was trying to make in this book is not so much that the war in Iraq is a disaster, which is something that almost everyone knows at this point, but to explain how it was in the America we live in, a sophisticated America with all these media sources, an administration, a government could sell a war that, as the president himself has now conceded, had nothing to do with 9/11. It's quite brilliant, really, and I have a sort of grudging admiration for the Bush production team.
Well, and you write it as if it were entirely stagecraft. You document the unraveling of the Bush administration claim of weapons of mass destruction, for instance, Vaclav Havel's statement.
Beginning after the weapons were clearly not being found, this all came out that they knew that much of what they were saying was false, or they'd been told by reliable sources it was false, and said it anyway. Indeed, in the case of the meeting in Prague...
And the meeting was alleged to have been between Mohammed Atta...
And an intelligence guy of Saddam's. And the Vaclav Havel statement turned out there was no meeting in the end. If memory serves, Dick Cheney kept saying it into 2004, long after it had been publicly sort of ridiculed and knocked down. When I started just making a list of all the things they learned in private that they didn't tell us, it turned out to be an appendix of 80 pages of the book because there were so many of them.
Well, and given that, several questions get begged, and you address one on page 96. You describe a scene where President Bush goes to meet with his military leaders at American base in Qatar and asked, okay, where are the WMDs? Could you describe that scene?
Basically, it was right after the official war was over. And he asked, you know, well, what's going on with the WMDs? Because already it was clear that something was off. And Paul Bremer says, well, it's Stephen Carbone, as I recall. And he says, well, who the hell is he? So it almost has a Marx Brothers quality if it weren't so tragic.
But he sounds as if, President Bush does, sound as if he really wants to know who's in charge of finding the WMDs and what have we found. So at that point, it sounds as if he really believes that they're there. On the next page, you quote Seymour Hersh, asking the question, was the administration lying to itself or did it deliberately give Congress and the public what it knew to be bad information? We could add to that, were members of the administration perhaps lying to President Bush? In other words, did you come up with an answer to the question? Did President Bush know?
I came up with a theory. The truth is, no one knows the answer to this question. Just as, by the way, no one really knows what exactly was the reason or combination of reasons that took us to war. My guess is that the president may not have known everything and maybe trusted too much in underlings and was possibly misled. But what I found in doing the research for this book and looking at the claims that were made and when they were made is that there was a consistent pattern. There was a lot of wrong intelligence. And when people in the administration say, you know, the Democrats saw that same intelligence, the Europeans saw it, they're being absolutely correct. They all saw it. But there was some intelligence that was conspicuously bad, and particularly about nuclear weapons, and particularly about alleged ties between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. Those were the two that were hyped the most. Now, is it that they fell in love, as Seymour Hersh sort of says, they fell in love with their own theory of the case, or did they deliberately hype something they knew to be false? We don't know the answer to that. To my mind, in some ways, it's a distinction without a difference because the net effect was the same in terms of absolutely trumpeting the stuff that was way off base.
Well, later in the book, though, you do try to come up with some conclusions. You quote Richard Haass, a former Bush administration State Department official, who was there at the beginning, he thinks he's going to go to his grave never knowing the answer why. Why did the Bush administration push so hard for war with Iraq?
I'm fascinated by this. And again, history is going to have to tell us the answer. But here's my take on it. We know there was a neoconservative contingent high up in the administration that did want this war to remake the Middle East for ideological reasons, spreading democracy, helping Israel. But we also know that after 9/11, according to Bob Woodward in one of his earlier books, Bush resisted administration attempts to go into Iraq over Afghanistan. He said, we want to keep our focus on al-Qaeda. Somehow that began to change in January 2002. What had happened by January 2002? Several things. First of all, the war that the country was united behind against the Taliban in Afghanistan was essentially over, at least at that time. We had knocked out this horrible regime that had shielded these terrorists who had wreaked mass murder on America. At the same time, in December of 2001, unbeknownst to the public yet, we had lost Osama bin Laden, perhaps through incompetence in Tora Bora. You get to 2002, the polls, which are very important to an administration where the most powerful figure in some ways is Karl Rove, start to show some slipping for this wartime president. Somewhere in this period, they start revving up a war in Iraq. And whether there's a mixture of politics, we're a kind of wag-the-dog situation on Rove's part, who went on record saying, we're going to sell this administration as a war presidency. It was a midterm election year. Or there are other factors that we don't know about. Something happened, and by the spring and summer, they were, according to the Downing Street memo, fixing the facts and intelligence to fit the predetermined policy of going to war. They had formed a White House Iraq group to promote a war, even as they said they hadn't decided on one yet, and this was full speed ahead. And the whole ratification of the war was pushed to force Congress to vote before the midterm elections of 2002. My guess is they thought this was going to be a very easy war, and it would be sort of like Grenada. It would be an easy hit, something that could be grandfathered into the war on terror, and they had plans to draw down to 30,000 troops by the end of the year. I think if they had known or thought about what might happen once they knocked down Saddam, they might not have been so gung-ho on this lovely little war that they had planned. To understand that, it seems cynical, but to understand
very
why,
cynical and it insulting. Does. It would seem insulting to many. So explain.
Right. What to me makes it clear that there was some mixture of politics and policy here is that there were no plans beyond knocking out Saddam. The cynicism of what they did was entirely predicated that this would be nothing. This would be an easy slam-dunk thing, and we would just get out of there right away. That's why they appointed Jay Garner, who is not an administrator or a nation builder or anything, just a sort of retired general, to come in after Saddam was out and just basically supervise sending the troops home. By the way, if it had worked out according to their plans, if there hadn't been an insurgency, if Iraq hadn't exploded into sectarian divisions and all the rest of it, they would have looked like heroes. Unfortunately, it didn't work out the way they planned, and I think the tragedy is they never thought it through.
Frank Rich, former New York Times theater critic, now columnist and author of The Greatest Story Ever Sold. We're going to take a minute break. When we come back, where was the press? Much more coming up with Frank Rich here and now. And now, and we're back with New York Times columnist Frank Rich, his new book, The Greatest Story Ever Sold. And Frank, Bob Woodward gets pilloried in your book. You call him a zealot for the Bush administration because of his uncritical first account of the administration, Bush at War. In his new book, Woodward is critical. He says, for instance, that former CIA Director George Tenet warned Condoleezza Rice of an imminent threat from al-Qaeda before 9/11, something she at first denied, then confirmed. So isn't that a get for Woodward?
I think there's no question that his new book adds details to the narrative, but we know the narrative. We already knew from Ron Suskind's 1% doctrine that not only in August did the president receive the famous, you know, bin Laden determined to attack U.S. president's daily intelligence brief, but that a CIA briefer was sent to Bush in person in Crawford to say much what Condi Rice was told a month earlier. And according to the Susskind book, which no one has challenged, Bush said, well, thanks for covering your you-know-what, and now get out. So Woodward is adding more details. I wish that he had gotten the story before the war had gone on as long as World War II.
Well, you also write that Richard Clark appeared on 60 Minutes. This was in March, said that Tenet told the president about an imminent attack in June, July, and August of 2001. But that story the next day got buried. You know, as you read through these, as you read the timeline, why wasn't there more reaction to much of this?
Well, one of the interesting things I learned in writing the book was, as you say, a lot of it was hiding in plain sight. 10 days before we invaded, Mohammed al-Baradei of the UN Atomic Energy Group said that these papers that were claiming the Saddam uranium deal in Africa were forgeries, and it was not on any of the network news broadcasts. So what was going on? I think two things. First of all, this country was traumatized, and understandably so. This country wanted to rally around its leader, and it did. And the press is human, just like the rest of the country. Also gave him the benefit of the doubt. What happened was, as the months went by, I feel very strongly this administration took that goodwill and used it to hijack this for the war in Iraq. The public, it can be understood somewhat, because they didn't know about Iraq. They didn't know about al-Qaeda. We were hearing about shark attacks in Gary Condit the summer that Osama bin Laden was plotting. The public isn't professional journalists. Journalists were too slow to be skeptical. And I think we were asleep at the switch. I think this war never could have been sold from scratch if there had been no 9/11. It has to be looked at against the backdrop of that horrible attack on the country and the mood that followed it.
But you also don't leave out your own employer, the New York Times. We had Carlotta Gall on this program saying she was in Afghanistan and knew about detainee abuse there long before Abu Ghraib, but her pieces were buried, while Judith Miller's reports about proof of weapons of mass destruction went on the front page. And then describe how those front page reports became part of a sort of an echo chamber.
I think one of the hallmark moments of the run-up to the war occurs in September, right after Labor Day of 2002. Andrew Card has told the New York Times that we don't roll out a new product in August, referring to the Iraq War. And suddenly it was a few days later, it was after Labor Day, and they were rolling it out, and the Times was part of that rollout. We had a story co-authored by Judith Miller on the front page of the Times talking about aluminum tubes in Saddam's presumed possession that may have something to do with nuclear weapons. In the piece, an unnamed official was quoted as saying, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. That morning, on five different Sunday morning political talk shows out of Washington, Cheney, Powell, Condi Rice, others said, don't believe us. Look at the front page of the New York Times. There are these aluminum tubes, and you know what? The smoking gun could be a mushroom cloud. It was as if the whole thing were scripted, and we now know that whatever defectors, whoever was the source for this Times piece, were pulling our leg. I guess it's the best way to put it. I still don't know the whole story, but it was certainly an inaccurate story, which the paper would later apologize for. But it showed the hand-in-glove way that the administration and the press were sort of pursuing the same storyline.
Well, and you're also a theater critic, so you look at stories like that through that prism. You call Valerie Plame a McMuffin. That's a term Hitchcock used to mean a distraction. Her husband, Joseph Wilson, is a Rosencrantz or Guildenstern, in other words, a side story. And speaking of echo chambers, you liken a fictional press conference in the film Chicago to one held by President Bush.
Well, there was this famous press conference, or notorious, several weeks before we invaded Iraq. It was the last chance that the Washington Press Corps had to challenge, in public at least, the storyline the administration was rolling out. As someone counted, I think the New York Observer, eight different times in that press conference, the president conflated Iraq and 9/11. And you have this press corps sort of asking questions that are beside the point. You had one questioner ask the president about his spiritual values in light of planning for war. And at that moment, the big hit movie in the country was Chicago. And it couldn't help but remind me of Richard Gere, this lawyer slash con man, selling the press on the innocence of a client in a song called They Both Reach for the Gun to make it self-defense. And indeed, what was the line being used to sell the Iraq War? It was self-defense. Mushroom clouds were coming our way. Chicago was based on a view of the press at that time in one of the great press newspaper cities, Chicago, that in some ways, to our amazement, can still come back and slap us in the face and haunt us when we see the press fall down on its job in the 21st century.
Frank Rich, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let me hear it.
The gun, oh yes, they both reach for the gun, for the gun.
A little louder.
Frank Rich's new book is The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. For more on the book and the book tour, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Warren Beatty's Red still to come here and now.
Funding for Here and Now.
Here and Now. The sound of horse-drawn buggies clip-clopping along country roads in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania today as Amish families gathered to bury four of the five young girls gunned down inside their small rural schoolhouse on Monday. The girls were killed by a 32-year-old milk delivery man who then took his own life. The funerals are being held in the farms where the children lived. Burial services will follow at the community cemetery just miles from the schoolhouse. This is a community that shuns the modern world and is committed to Christ's message of forgiveness. But how is it possible to forgive such a crime? Well, to try to understand, we called up Donald Crabill, a senior fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. He's written several books on Amish life and culture. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, you know, suddenly we're being reminded of many different groups, Mennonites, Amish, and we understand that they are sects or subgroups of the Anabaptist breakaway movement. What is the Anabaptist movement?
The Anabaptists started themselves in 1525 in Zurich, Switzerland, and the people in this movement thought that when people become affiliated with a church, that should be a voluntary decision. They should make that decision as adults, and then only as adults be baptized. But they were themselves had been baptized as infants in the Catholic or Protestant churches, and so they were nicknamed Anabaptists, meaning twice baptized. That decision was a very difficult one because many of them eventually were killed and died as martyrs. Adult baptism was a capital offense. And so this tradition of suffering and martyrdom is very much a part of the Amish way of thinking still today.
But you also remind us of something else. Now, these Amish were not baptized as children and then again as adults. They are only baptized as adults. So does that mean that these children who were killed were not yet baptized?
And that's correct. The children who were killed were not yet baptized. The Amish church would view them as safe and secure in the arms of Jesus going on to heaven. They would say that a person's not really accountable morally for their eternal destiny until they're in their later teens. And typically, Amish young people would be baptized between 18 and 22.
But there is some solace there, though, that they're not wishing they had been baptized. In other
That's
words,
correct.
Right. Well, what is going on inside these homes? We understand there's a burial, but that the what we think of as a funeral process is largely held inside the home. Can you paint the picture for us? What is happening inside these homes?
Well, there's actually three stages to this process. Over the last 2 days, many families in the community would have come to the homes. They were meeting with the parents that were grieving over the loss of their children. They would bring food. They were doing work for them, milking their cows, and hundreds of them would have been surrounding these parents with words of consolation, with words of support, with words of sympathy, and so on. today, the funerals are taking place, and the funerals are not held in the house, but are often held in a barn or another large outdoor outside building, a shop or something like that, because typically, even in a regular funeral, there would be 300 or 400 people that would be coming. The funeral typically would take place in the morning. There would be perhaps two sermons in Pennsylvania German. There would be prayers that would be read using the German Bible that would have been have the more archaic German of Martin Luther's time, and then also scripture reading. There would not be any singing. There would also be a second viewing before or after the funeral, and then there would be a procession of carriages and buggies and horses out to a nearby cemetery where the burial would take place after another viewing, another opportunity for viewing the body.
We understand also that the families and friends have been making special clothing to dress the bodies with. They build the coffins.
There's something really interesting here. The Amish are not afraid of death. They have large families. They have seen death before, and they actually touch the body and dress the body. And so there's a willingness to confront death and to be close to death.
We understand, too, that the focus in the service is on God rather than the deceased. Is there a eulogy?
There would not be a eulogy at all in a traditional sense. There wouldn't be a focus on the individual. The focus would really be more on the yieldedness, on accepting God's will, understanding that this is part of God's providence, understanding that there may be a higher meaning and a higher purpose here.
We read in the New York Times that the Amish have started a charity fund, not just for the victims' families, but for the gunman's widow.
That's very much in the Amish tradition of extending forgiveness and wanting to love the enemy, not retaliate in any violent way to their opponents. Again, that's their teaching from the New Testament. And so this fund for the killer's family is certainly in keeping with their spirit.
Have you been talking to any of the Amish families?
I was talking with a close Amish friend today. He didn't have any children that died in this, but he said that our community, meaning the Amish community, has been very touched and just overwhelmed by all the outside support and the prayers of people from the outside. So he was very grateful for that.
Did he also say maybe, you know, a little nervous? Because once again, it shines the spotlight on this such a private community. I mean, it's an intrusion as well, or maybe not.
Well, the media spotlight is a tremendous intrusion. I was on site there on Tuesday morning for several hours, and there are just dozens and dozens of TV camera crews, satellite dishes, big generators running these trucks, and it's clogging the roadways. It's hard for the Amish people even to get in and go from home to home because of all the media attention. And with reporters trying to track down and take photographs of each Amish person they see. So it is a very big intrusion. The Amish certainly don't welcome that. They tend to shy away from publicity. They discourage publicity.
And explain to us again, they don't like to have their pictures taken because?
The Amish have a long-standing taboo about posing for photographs, feeling that that is a violation of one of the Ten Commandments, that they should not have graven images that would be like a god or like an idol. I think there's a sociological reading here that a photograph is about individualism and showing the individual how they're unique and different. And the Amish would say, this is just calling attention to yourself. It's just trying to show how you're better than other people to have a photograph of you taken.
One last question. What should the average person do if someone wanted to extend themselves, you know, either in the area or from somewhere else, to these people? Well, how do you do that?
The parents are going to have tremendous medical bills. They don't have commercial insurance, so if someone wanted to, they could make a financial contribution to one of several funds that have been set up to help the family.
If you forget about that, no insurance. Donald Crabill, Senior Fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. as sometimes happens, we turn to sports to momentarily take us away from it all, or at least try to. The Major League Baseball playoffs are in full swing. College and pro football kicking into gear. The Zamboni's out for the start of the National Hockey League season. So joining us in the studio to put all of this in perspective, our good friend and sports fan, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game every weekend. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Robin.
And to the baseball playoffs first. We're not going to mention the team that didn't make it into the postseason, the Red Sox.
Oops.
Oh, did, right. But there are some interesting matchups, some exciting games, and an unusual play. Tell us about this play that caught your eye.
An unusual play, so unusual it was an unprecedented play. Poor guy, Russell Martin, at bat, gets a base hit with men on first and second for the Dodgers. He has every reason to think he's done a very good thing. And the play ends with the two guys who were on base both getting tagged out almost simultaneously at home. The first one, Jeff Kent, is a very slow runner, and he wasn't sure the ball wouldn't be caught, so he hesitated. The second one, J.D. Drew, put his head down and ran like crazy because he was sure he was going to score from first. The catcher tagged out Jeff Kent and turned away because he thought the play was over, turned away to show the umpire that he still had the ball, and his teammates are screaming at him, "Hey, here comes another guy!" Turned around and tagged out the second guy. So two outs, it was virtually a double play into a double play.
Talk about who's on first. Well, the Mets and Dodgers and the Yankees and Tigers both scheduled to play again in New York today. We're going to watch another Subway Series between the Mets and the Yankees?
I have to say that's something of a long shot, not to steal Pete Rose's thunder, who has learned nothing and is therefore handicapping baseball on national television these days for David Letterman. Anyway, I don't think so. The Yankees are a little sketchy about whether they're going to have Randy Johnson. The Mets have lost two pitchers already going into the postseason. I think they'll get through their first series, but I'm not sure that especially they'll get any further than that.
Okay. Well, a little baseball history, though. I know on your program coming up this weekend, twice in several markets, some of us listen twice, you're going to look back at Don Larsen's perfect game for the Yankees in the 1956 World Series. Tell us about that.
Great fun, because not only is Don Larsen still around, and I had an opportunity to speak to him, and he's fantastic. The book about Don Larsen's perfect game in the World Series was written by his second cousin, a fellow named Phil Hose, who was 9 years old when Larsen threw the perfect game. And poor Phil was a kind of a scrawny elementary school kid who didn't really know baseball. His nickname in his school was Moron. That's what everybody called him.
Tells you a lot.
And all of a sudden, his second cousin throws a perfect game in the World Series, and Phil becomes a celebrity, and his life is changed. And he's written this book sort of, "Thank you, Cousin Don, you really turned it around for me."
What a great story. Well, let's turn to a terrible one. Pro football, an ugly story from last week. A player from the Tennessee Titans suspended because he stomped on the head of another player. Longest suspension ever for an on-field incident, we understand. And describe this incident.
Well, Albert Haynesworth, playing for the Titans, first stomped on Andre Gourad's head, and then his helmet popped off, and then he kicked him in the face. The result of all this was 30 stitches and a trip to the plastic surgeon. Gourad, according to the most recent account I've read, is still having some blurred vision, still having some problems. Not surprising after you get your head stepped on and get kicked in the face. It is, as you mentioned, the longest suspension that any NFL player has ever been assessed with, and it will cost Mr. Haynesworth roughly one-third of his $1.5 million salary.
He has said he was sorry, and he'll accept any punishment he receives.
Yeah, well, that helps. Unfortunately, he also has a history of violent behavior on the football field. And
so we'll change that.
We'll see what happens.
Okay, real quick, I just have to ask you about this new basketball that's being used in the NBA games this fall. It's made by Spalding. The ball is made by Spalding that they've always used. That hasn't changed in more than 30 years. But there's this new one that's Shaquille O'Neal says, it feels like the ones we use, real people?
Well, Shaquille O'Neal says it feels like the cheapo indoor-outdoor balls that you buy at, the convenience store.
The ones we use.
Exactly. And Pat Riley backs him up. His coach, Pat Riley, says it's a horrible ball, and he doesn't even have to shoot it.
Okay, well, we'll see if it affects the game. Bill Littlefield hosts NPR's Only a Game every weekend. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Here and Now with this quick news update. As we mentioned earlier, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has stopped off in Baghdad. The State Department said Rice's landing was delayed by 35 minutes due to indirect fire, either from mortar rounds or rockets in the airport area, underscoring the fact that Rice arrives as violence in Iraq shows no sign of abating. At least 21 U.S. soldiers have been killed since Saturday, a disproportionately high number. Most of those died in Baghdad amid a massive security sweep that's been going on since August. Rice says she's in Iraq to tell Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki that the government has limited time to settle a wide variety of political differences, such as how to divide oil wealth and possible changes to the Constitution. She told reporters that obviously the security side and political side are linked. The war, now in its fourth year, has claimed the lives of more than 2,700 American troops, thousands of Iraqi civilians, and has cost more than $300 billion. Reds, Warren Beatty's improbable epic saga about radical American journalist John Reed, was released 25 years ago, just as a generation of early 20th century social activists was aging. Beatty's film captured their stories and combined them with a star-studded fiction narrative, so long it was the last Hollywood picture to be released with an intermission. The result, 3 Oscars out of 12 nominations, a screening in the Reagan White House, and a legacy in the history of filmmaking. WNYC's Sarah Fischko explains the curious construction of Reds.
Toward the end of the disco era that had flourished in New York in the mid to late 70s, one of the biggest film editing crews ever assembled was housed in the Studio 54 building. Studio 54 had been the street-level center of all decadent velvet rope disco life in those years. But upstairs, there were serious editors at work.
My name is John Reed. I write for the magazine The Masses, and I want to know if the Socialist Party is going to organize demonstrations
on a movie which would come to be called Reds. It was Warren Beatty's pet project and obsession.
I'd known him since Bonnie and Clyde, and I guess he trusted me, and that's what a working relationship is about, is trust.
Film editor Dee Dee Allen, who also served as executive producer, had joined co-writer, producer, director, and star Warren Beatty right at the beginning. There was said to have been more than 1 million feet of film shot in 5 countries.
Having a lot of film never scares me. Having not enough film scares me. I don't mind 1 million choices.
Look, I'm on my way to Russia.
Oh, really? Have you enlisted?
Very funny.
Reds was a film about the life of the radical American journalist John Reed, the love of his life, fellow activist Louise Bryant, and their work in the tumultuous early 20th century through the years of the Russian Revolution.
I appreciate your
Well,
life.
The place to be now is Russia.
Oh, thank you. I'll remember that.
Louise, it's chaos.
Warren Beatty's idea was to use real people to tell part of the story, surrounding and commenting on the dramatic action.
Now, my idea about Jack Reed is probably different from most, but I know him well.
They were referred to as witnesses in the film's credits, and many of them had been on one side or the other of the same struggles that had engaged Reed and Bryant in those days.
And I have an idea, I may be wrong in this, that his wife was a communist.
All of that stuff was shot prior to the actual principal photography.
Co-editor Craig McKay.
They were leaving us faster than they were staying around, so we had to get them on film.
Beatty and his cameraman, Vittorio Storaro, had a special black tent they could take around the country so they could shoot all the witnesses against the same neutral black velvet background.
It was like creating cameos. It was a perfect backdrop.
Special sequences editor Catherine Wenning.
Against black velvet, it takes them out of time and space.
Jack Reed's life, short as it was, happened at a time, and all of us, after all, are the victims of our time and place. When he had the opportunity, as a reporter, to be in some very exciting and dramatic places.
Doesn't everybody can be buried in the Kremlin?
The editors struggled to mix their testimony with drama, because after all, there was plenty of drama.
I don't think we like the same people or the same kind of life, and I want to be on my own.
Go ahead, be on your own. I don't give a damn. Be on your own anyway.
I know you don't give a damn.
Will you tell me why the hell I should give a damn?
It's an extremely hard thing when you have a narrative line moving forward and you've got your story engine working. And to interrupt that with interviews, you know, in a documentary style. And so that was our biggest concern. not to stop the narrative. And so there was a lot of trial and error.
I never forgot Emma Goldman. She inspired me to the very depths.
Some of those people were tried every place in the movie until finally, you know, oh, it works.
Greenwich Village was there, and New York was around it.
They experimented with using these interviews to voice over shots, setting the scene, and bravely just moving right into Diane Keaton as Louise Bryant, for example.
No?
Entering Jack Reed's village apartment.
Hello, Jack?
It got more complicated than that, intercutting at some point.
If men really disapproved of war, dear, we'd have stopped wars years ago. Men like war.
Going right from commentary to a staged scene of a John Reed speech. Sometimes they just explained history in the most personal way possible.
The complete transformation of Russian society and the taking over by the peasants and the workers of the machinery of the state had never happened before in history.
They philosophized, too, right in the middle of the movie.
We all have problems. You can't escape having problems, don't you know? But to take on the problem of all humanity, to save all humanity, my God, that was too big even for Jesus Christ. Don't you know? He got himself crucified. How the hell did we expect to do those things?
Catherine Wenning remembers the day they took it just a little too far. The use of the witnesses was out of balance.
Warren said, oh, my God, the dramatic action can't hold up to the reality. It was too overpowering. And they had to be scaled back and used differently.
And the creative pendulum swung the other way, too. At one point in the process, they just took all the witnesses completely out of the cut.
But, you know, didn't work. It was very simple, you know. And so back they went. It's amazing what they added to the whole piece.
Reds, after 2 years of cutting in the long corridors of editing rooms over the discotheque, began to take shape into a finished version.
I remember Dee Dee and I looking at the first cut, and everybody in the room when the lights went up, I mean, we were just totally blown away. We knew, I mean, we even knew before that. You really do know when you've got something that's sort of more than words, deeper than that.
It was a passionate tale and an unusual way to tell a tale because it was very political. And at the same time, it was very human. Who else makes pictures like that? People don't think that way today.
Reds, with stellar performances by Beatty, Diane Keaton, Maureen Stapleton, Jack Nicholson, and many others, and a group of witnesses that included Adele Nathan, Roger Baldwin, and Henry Miller, was 3 hours and 20 minutes long.
There's not a bit of it I don't love.
Without the living archive provided by the so-called witnesses in Reds, it might have been just another docudrama, albeit a very good one. With them, it became something else entirely. A meditation on memory and history, and on how to tell an epic story with, of all things, intimacy. And it was in those editing rooms that the critical connections were made.
I think it's the film I'm proudest of.
It was really bathed in intelligence, and it spoke to people who were hungry for that.
That's a hunger that doesn't disappear.
Sarah Fischko produced our story on Reds, which comes out on DVD later this month. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, Hitesh Hathi, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our intern is Katie Falsigno. Managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.